convened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We have 03-0920 State Ex Rel Leroy, is it Reich? Reich versus David Schwartz. Arguing for Mr. Reich is Christopher J. Is it Shirella? Good. Counsel, you may proceed.
Madam Chief Justice, members of the Court, Counsel, my name is Christopher J. Chirella, and I represent the petitioner, appellant petitioner, Mr. Leroy Reich, who also appears in court in person, to my right and your left. Good afternoon. The main reason why we're here today is to discuss the revocation of my client's parole in Dodge County case number 93-CF-40. And before I get into my argument, I believe that there are two main substantive arguments that I would like to address the Court today. But before I do so, there are certain facts that I believe are undisputed that I wish to make known to the Court that will shed a little bit of light on my argument. Number one, there's no dispute that my client was convicted in case number 93-CF-40 and sentenced to 8 years in prison under the old law. This was not a truth in sentencing case, but an old law case. His mandatory release date was July 21st, 1998. While at Kettle Moraine Correctional Institution, which is a state prison, he was provided with rules of supervision prior to his mandatory release date. He also discussed with a social worker at that facility the various residences that would be available to him. And the rules, I believe, were not signed, and there was no the residency issue was not taken care of. So on July 21st, 1998, his mandatory release date under the old law, he was transferred to a county jail, the Dodge County Jail. So instead of being released, he was taken, in essence, in custody to another facility. While at the Dodge County Jail, subsequent to his mandatory release date, he engaged in further conduct, which ultimately led to his revocation, which eventually got us to this point. There were four main reasons why he was revoked. Very simply, he was revoked for failing to have a suitable residence, failing to cooperate with staff at the Dodge County Jail when he got there on July 21st, 1998, for failing to obey the rules of the Dodge County Jail. I believe, looking at the transcript from the Administrative Revocation hearing on page 20, it was because he failed to empty his tray out into the garbage after eating. Finally, he was revoked because of activity on July 27, 1998, for failing to give a statement to his agent. His agent came to see him. He was in custody in a cell and refused to leave the cell shackled and go talk to his agent. Based upon that conduct, revocation proceedings were commenced, and he was ultimately revoked.
Counselor, when he was in the Dodge County Jail, could he have walked out the door? If someone left the door open, would he have been charged with escape?
Absolutely.
What do you base that on?
Well, at that point, he's still in custody. He's still a prisoner. And while still a prisoner, while in custody, while incarcerated, if you step out the door without the authority of those who are detaining you, obviously that's escape.
Is it automatic that on the mandatory release that you're on parole? Can you be released without parole?
Well, that's one of the issues I wanted to address with the Court today, whether or not one can have the dual status of a parolee and a prisoner. The argument that I'm making on behalf of my client is the answer to that question is simply no. You cannot hold the dual status of parolee and prisoner. And I base that upon the following. There have been statements in both the briefs filed by myself, and I'm not sure that Ms. Mueller was in agreement with me in the briefs, but I held the contention that there were two cases out there that controlled that particular issue, that being the two Masamone cases that were decided by District 2 back in 1998 and the Woods case that came after that. One thing to keep in mind when we answer this question as to whether or not one has the dual status is this. Masamone and Woods were decided by the same three-judge panel out of District 2. The first case that came through, the Masamone case, was a pro se individual who was still in custody. Before being transferred on parole, he made the statement, in essence, to his agent, I'm not going to go on parole on an electronic monitoring bracelet if that's the condition you want to put upon me. So The agent said, well, we're going to keep you in custody unless and until you do that. He simply challenged at that point in time to the District 2 Court of Appeals the authority of his agent to place a bracelet upon him, never raising the issue that you can't keep me in custody past my MR date. Simply, you can't put this condition upon me. When faced with the issue in Nesimone, the District 2 Court simply said this. In essence, they had the authority to put that bracelet upon you, and given that fact, we're going to say that they could do what they did. However, the court never addressed the issue, because it was never put forth to them by this pro se individual, as to whether or not the agent at that time had the authority to keep him in custody pending his decision to wear the bracelet. 1 year later, that same court, those same three individuals, are faced with the direct question by, in the case of Woods, where, in essence, the client says, my MR date has come, you've placed me at another facility, I believe it was the Shurer facility, and I haven't been released. You have no authority to hold me past my mandatory release date based upon conduct that I've done here because my MR has come and gone. In essence, I am no, when they attempted to revoke him or take his parole away, he said, you can't do so because I am a parolee, and I am not yet a parolee, I am still a prisoner. Having made that argument, the same District 2 Court of Appeals said, you're absolutely right. You cannot hold the dual status of parolee and prisoner. While he was still in prison, in essence, he was subject to the rules of the prison, and he was not subject to the rules of parole, so you can't revoke that which doesn't exist.
But counsel, isn't that the distinction between the two cases? In one instance, Woods, you ended up being transferred, the individual ended up being transferred to another prison setting. In the situation involving Massimone, the transfer was to a county jail. And isn't that a valid distinction to make? I'm thinking about the situation, for instance, where someone can be held on a parole hold or held on a probation hold. Usually those holds occur in a county jail. Now, you're not saying that they're no longer on parole because there's a parole hold, are you? How is this different? I'm having trouble understanding the difference, and I know I've given you a compound situation now. First of all, isn't that a valid distinction between Woods and Massimone, the placement? And secondly, how do you distinguish a parole hold from what was going on with your client?
Well, to answer your first question, I don't believe it's a valid distinction. And I base that upon the language that this Court utilized in Gilbert, and I've cited that language in my brief, where this Court has stated that custody is, in essence, imprisonment and legal restraint. And we all know that when somebody's in prison, somebody's in jail, that they're in custody. And we talk about custody as a deprivation of liberty, meaning you have no liberty interest. You're behind bars.
Counsel, as a practical matter, I'll ask the State the same question.
Yeah, I'd love to have it answer my question first, if we could.
Sorry about that.
And we also know that parole or probation, and I tell this to my clients all the time because I do a lot of litigation work, it's that when you're on probation or parole, it's conditional liberty, okay? It's not a deprivation of liberty, but it is, in essence, a conditional liberty. You're not in custody, but there are certain rules and regs that you have to follow. So if your question to me is it different, is it a valid distinction that in one case he was transferred to a prison versus a county jail, I don't believe so. Because the case that came subsequent thereto, and this is important also, I believe, decided by the same court, two of the same three judges in Olson v. Litcher said 1 year later in the year 2000 that on your mandatory release date, you must be released. In both of these cases, in Nesimone and in Woods, the MR date had come and gone, and the person was still in custody. 2 years after Nesimone was first decided, the court said, look, we don't care if you can't find housing for this convicted sex offender. We don't care if the community can't find a place for this. Until the legislature says otherwise, you have to let this gentleman go. So in answer to your question, I respectfully say, no, I don't believe it's a valid distinction.
How do you draw the distinction between a parole hold and what was going on with your client? Your client is transferred to a county jail. He's on parole, the department says. The department says, but we're going to hold him in the county jail until these other matters are cleared up, and then they take on revocation proceedings.
Simply stated,
how is that different?
I'm sorry. Simply stated, a parole hold is granted or taken against somebody when they are effectively placed on parole. Okay?
So isn't the state's argument here he's placed on parole and now he's being held in the county jail like any other person placed on parole could be held in the county jail on a parole hold?
That may well be the state's argument, but here's my argument to counteract that. You have the right, at least the way the legislature has set this up, and especially with truth in sentencing, we have initial confinement time and we have extended supervision time. My understanding of the statutory law is that you serve your time, just like in this case, and then you'd serve your extended supervision time. And when we're in court, the judges always say there is no parole. Let's face it, extended supervision is a glorified parole. You have the right under the law right now, when you have served your time, to be released. Once you are released, and you've gotten that statutory right to be released, you effectively become a parolee. At which point, if you violate the terms and conditions given to you of your parole, you have, the agent at that point can place a parole hold on you. To answer your question, Justice Crooks, no, I don't believe that that was a parole hold because, once again, I make the simple argument, you cannot place a hold on something that does not yet exist.
Mr. Trella.
That was my question. As I understand it, your client was transferred to custody because he failed to comply with the parole rules. In other words, the way you're setting up the system, a person would get out at their MR. You would then they would set up the rules. So this is like saying that he knew beforehand he wasn't going to comply with certain rules. He told them he would not sign certain agreements, which I think under the old indeterminate sentencing procedure was the way it was done, and maybe even on supervised release. But you're setting up a system that they could not institute any rules until the person is out. And then, if he or she violated the rules, then they could take them back into custody. But as I understand, he was transferred from prison to jail because he would not comply. He went to jail because he would not comply with the rules. That's just, and I think that puts the spin on, I think, that the state is attempting to state here.
That's correct. And, you know, when I was speaking to my colleagues in my office about this case yesterday in preparation for this argument, this issue came up, and I knew this question was going to be posed, and I want to answer it. Getting back to what I said before about one has the right to be released, I don't agree with you, with all due respect, Justice Wilcox, that this gentleman violated his rules in this particular case simply because there were rules established, but having not yet been placed outside of the institution and on parole, he really didn't violate anything.
But didn't he have to sign something? Wasn't that the agreement? Maybe I misread this, but I thought he had to actually, he refused to sign. So he refused to acknowledge that he had to comply with these rules.
Yes. And here's what I'm proposing is my argument today is there's got to be a bright line rule, and the bright line rule should be one needs to be released subsequent to their MR date or their initial confinement time, at least the way the statute's written, unless the legislature wants to change it.
What sense would that make if you're going to have somebody that's going to violate the rules in which they already knew? You mean he gets first kick at the cat, he gets an opportunity to violate, to harm someone's safety, that doesn't seem to, you're saying that that's what the state has to do.
That's correct. In this particular case, my client failed to apparently signed certain rules, and he failed to find suitable housing according to where the probation department or the parole department wanted him to stay. Here's my proposal. He leaves the institution, and the agent sees him outside the facility and says, you need to sign these rules. And I actually posed this question to my client today, and the answer was in the affirmative. You tell the individual, you need to sign these rules right now, okay? I'm going to have you stay at this halfway house. And if you don't sign these rules, if you don't follow my rules and stay at this halfway house, you're going to turn right back around and you're going right back into that facility that you just came out of.
Mr. Trella, if I could follow up on Justice Wilcox's question. And if I want to separate for the moment the violations that are alleged on July 22nd and July 27th of 98. If you go back to what Justice Wilcox has asked about, the fact that he apparently refused to sign the rules, back on June 29th, which is roughly 3 weeks before his mandatory release date, looking at Mesma and looking at the facts of this case, how is this any different than Garski versus State and State versus Smith in a probation setting where a defendant has a right to refuse probation by his conduct, by his refusal to sign the rules here? Isn't he, in effect, refusing to comply with parole? Which puts him in a little different setting than saying he's on parole but not released. Here he's refusing to acknowledge the parole to begin with. How is that any different than Garski and Smith?
I don't know how. I guess to answer that, I don't necessarily know, Justice, if he's refusing parole. He's simply refusing to go along with certain rules that the agent wants him to follow. He's not subject to parole, at least from my perspective, until the date of his MR, in this particular, under the new law, until the date of extended supervision. You place him outside the facility. If he doesn't sign the rules on that date, he's then in violation. He's refusing to follow the rules that the agent is attempting to establish for him. And my point is this. If somebody steps outside the facility and the agent says, you don't do X, Y, and Z, you're walking right back into that facility, I guarantee you 95% of the people that refused before, unless they're idiots, they're not going to refuse again.
Where is the rule that says he has to be on probation?
Parole?
Where is the parole, I'm sorry. Where is the rule that says they have a right to do, to give conditions after mandatory release? What's that?
That's administratively the agents have to go over rules, and that's under the DOC code. I'm thinking more prospectively as to how this case is going to affect the new statute. I believe it's in the statute that you serve X period of time.
Well, that's right. You're required to serve extended supervision under the new statutes. And I keep asking you, are you required to be on parole after the mandatory release date?
Under the old law, under these facts?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And where do you get that from?
I don't have the statute in front of me, but my understanding under the administrative code is that that exists, that language exists.
Counsel, can you petition to extend MR if there was failure to sign or failure to live up to some proposed conditions?
Does the agent have that right? I haven't briefed it. I haven't looked into it. If a statute or an administrative code section at this point in time exists such that that's the case, obviously that's a remedy that the agent can take.
One of the briefs of your two briefs mentioned that in passing, the possibility of extending MR, but I can't remember at this time which of the two. Let me jump then to an additional question.
Okay.
A problem that I have with your argument is that it seems to be suggestive of a facade and something that doesn't resonate with the way that I think the real world works. You are suggesting that at that date, even though he's failed, arguably, let's say he has, failed to sign rules, failed to comply with rules, that he still must be released. But the way that this works is you have the Sheriff's Department call over to the parole and send over Mrs. Smith. And Mrs. Smith comes and she kind of either stands 10 feet outside the front door of the jail or maybe walks down the hallway with him in the jail. And as soon as he opens the door and walks one step over the threshold into the fresh air and the snow, she says, by the way, you have a right to remain silent. No, I'm just teasing. She says, by the way, you have to sign these things. And if you don't sign these things, then I have just in preparation, lined up Deputy Smith and Deputy Jones, thank you. And they're waiting right there. So does this facade have to play out every time there's someone who says, no, I don't want to follow that, I don't want to sign that, but you got to let me go? That's what the problem I have.
I understand, and that was one of the issues that I obviously was concerned about in making this argument, but I based that argument simply upon the Woods decision and the Olson decision. I think Olson v. Litcher makes very clear that on your MR date, you've got to be released for whatever reason. And I'm calling it a statutory right that there is a difference between being in custody and being released to parole. And I'm basing that upon the case law that this Court has laid down as being custody being incarceration and parole not necessarily being incarceration. So in the answer to your question, is it a facade? Yes and no. That gets back to my earlier hypothetical. I think you're going to potentially, and this is maybe a terrible way of looking at it, but it may limit some probation agent from, a probation agent that may not necessarily like a particular client from, saying, well, you know what, I'm just not going to let this guy go. Okay, and I'm going to say he did X, Y, and Z, and we're just going to go right ahead and go with parole revocation. Whereas if the guy walks out of the facility and you tell him these are the rules and he signs them, then he goes out onto the streets and he goes out onto the streets on parole. Which is, and once again, I talked to my client about this earlier, and I asked him, if you would have walked out of the facility on your MR and your agent said, these are the rules and this is where you need to live, what would you have done? Well, he looked at me kind of stupidly like, oh, of course I would have signed them.
But another defendant would look to you equally stupidly and say, are you kidding? She's 5'2", I'm 6'8", no other people were there. I thought it would blow up, I'm leaving.
That's the end of it then.
Could I ask another question? This is sort of a variation on Justice Crook's question about parole holds. Let's suppose, now, this is hypothetical now.
Sure.
Suppose we have a defendant who is released on parole, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And then the person is picked up and taken to jail because of a parole hold. Maybe there's public intoxication or something that violated a rule. And in the jail, he solicits another prisoner for sex. I think that was the facts of some case I read. Can that solicitation be used as a violation of the conditions of parole, or is it your position that once you get back into jail, you're not on parole anymore?
No, at that point, it's effectively a parole hold. He's been released. He's been placed on parole. He's been taken into custody on a hold. And your question is, can you use that conduct over and above any criminal conduct, can you use that as another allegation against that gentleman? Is that the question?
Yeah,
I believe you can, yes.
Because it's a violation of parole?
That's correct. And albeit that individual is in custody, but that individual has been granted at some point in time the conditional liberty of parole and, in essence, erred.
But then you can't be saying that a parole and custody are exclusive of each other. There must be some circumstances, and I think this was Justice Crooks was getting at, that they overlap.
At that particular stage, yes, but that is a parole hold that in and of itself is custody. Nobody would argue against the statement that when that parole hold is placed on the gentleman, your hypothetical, that individual is in custody. Everybody would suggest that, yes, he's in custody. There's a deprivation of liberty at that point in time. My factual scenario, I believe, is a little bit different because in Mr. Risch's case, he was never placed out onto the streets and given the opportunity.
Well, the Litcher case seems to say that at the moment there's the mandatory release date, it's an obligation to release. Well, if the authorities say this person cannot be released unconditionally and the defendant will not accept the conditions, they, in effect, have to transfer the person to another facility in order to revoke probation, don't they?
I don't agree with that. The way I read the Litcher case is simply that in that particular case, we had a convicted sex offender that they couldn't find suitable housing for, and the court said, it doesn't matter. If this is the condition that you want, you have to find suitable housing, and you can't do it, you still need to release the gentleman. You You can't just simply place him in another correctional facility for ad nauseum until you can find a place for him. So in answer to your question, no, I don't believe that the transfer should or could occur. I think the person has to be given the opportunity to get that conditional liberty after having served the first portion of their sentence. And once again, I'm talking prospectively with regard to the TIS 2 law.
Your point is that Mr. Reich never reached parole status.
That's correct. That's correct. He never got, once again, you can't revoke that which does not exist. So he never reached parole status because he was never effectively paroled. Having not been paroled, you can't revoke that particular status. And that's what Wood said.
But really, you're saying what Justice Bradley referred to, you have to go through a sort of ritual of releasing someone and then instantly revoking them.
Assuming they don't follow the rules or regulations that the agent wants to set up, yes.
But I guess the question that I have is, and that's why I say I want to separate out that which occurred before the mandatory release date from that which occurred after. Okay. If a person before mandatory release is indicating to the agent that I am not going to play by your rules, I am not going to do what you ask me to do, I am not going to sign anything, I'm going to go out the way I want to go out. Now, assume that's what we're looking at.
In essence, that's what Mr. Reich did.
Which is what happened here.
Sure.
Then, at that point, why do you have to go through the facade? And that's why I asked the question about refusing probation in a probationary setting. If a defendant has a right to refuse probation, and it's a conditional release setting, why can't a defendant refuse parole? Or can a defendant refuse parole, perhaps should be the question.
I'm on stop. Can I answer that question?
You shall.
As far as a defendant being able to refuse probation, that's a right that I'm trying to remember if that's a statutory right or not. They simply have the right to say no. Does an individual have the right to simply refuse parole? In reading the statute, I would say no. I mean, the legislature has said the following. You're going to serve under the old law, your mandatory release, and then you're going to go out onto parole. That's it. That's the law. Under the new law, you're going to serve your initial confinement, and you're going to go out on extended supervision. And once you get out on extended supervision, you don't follow the rules, you're right back where you started from.
You have somebody who's mandatory release. They've got to be released, under your argument, from prison, right?
Correct.
They can't be put on parole because they haven't signed for parole, right? And they're continued in an institutional capacity, right? That's what happened here.
Sure.
What rules do they have to obey? You can't keep him in prison, yet he's in prison. Does he have to obey the prison rules?
Well, that's what the Woods Court said, was that if you're still in custody and you're still in the prison or the jail and you violate one of the rules of that facility, well, the DOC has set up Section 303 specifically for those reasons.
Okay. Here, he was put in county jail. Does he have to obey the county jail rules?
Sure. And if he doesn't obey the county jail rules like he didn't do in this particular case, I believe that one of the things he did was he didn't put his tray away after eating.
Okay, well, what's the discipline? Let's assume that you should discipline somebody for not putting away the tray. Let's assume that that is a big violation of the county jail rules. What do you do with them?
According to what happened to Mr. Reich, he lost television privileges for 24 hours. And apparently that's
not provoking anything. He's still there. You keep him. How long do you keep him in county jail until he signs up? Do you keep him in prison until he signs what they want him to sign? Do you keep him in county jail until he signs what he wants to sign? I mean, rather than revoke parole, you got to have something to do with this person. You're suggesting putting him on the street with one step and forcing him to sign, or putting him in a position where he has to sign. Why can't you say the same thing? You're in the institution or you're in the county jail until you sign, buddy.
Because my interpretation of the law is that he has the right to move from deprived liberty to a conditional liberty, and if he refuses at the point where he's given that different form of liberty, at which point then he's on parole and you can revoke him.
Well, what you're giving him when he walks out is not conditional liberty. You're letting him take that first step free of any conditional liberty.
That's correct. And if he violates at that point in time, when he becomes a parolee, you can take him directly back into custody. In other words, you don't want to sign the rules? Fine. That's it. You're going right back where you came from.
You can't just save him as he's in the institution. You don't want to sign? You're not getting out of here.
Because my argument is simply that you can't hold that dual status.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank
Assistant
you.
Attorney General Marguerite Mohler, representing the state of Wisconsin, here David Schwartz.
May it please the court. Presumably, this court accepted review of this case to decide the underlying question of whether a person can have the status of a parolee, even though he has not been released from physical custody. Before reaching that question, this court will have to consider a preliminary question of jurisdiction, which I have set forth in the state's brief, but which I do not intend to address in my argument unless the court has specific questions. Instead, we'll just rely on the arguments set forth in the brief.
I have a question.
Yeah. Justice Prosser.
Suppose we really want to answer the question that we've just been discussing for the last 20 minutes or so. How do we not do damage to the basic principles of habeas corpus?
Wouldn't you be doing damage if you didn't address the issue? Is that what you're asking?
I mean, why don't you just summarize your argument on habeas corpus and then... If we believe that argument, how do we address the other question without doing damage to the principles that you're articulating?
My argument is that at the time that Mr. Reisch brought his habeas corpus action in the Dodge County Circuit Court, he was not in custody under the restraint he was challenging. And because he wasn't under that restraint, there was no subject matter jurisdiction for the Dodge County Circuit Court to take any action in that habeas proceeding. But what happened was that the former district attorney and Mr. Chirella stipulated that in the context of that habeas action where Mr. Reisch was claiming his attorney in the first certiorari proceeding was ineffective, that they would just reinstate the cert action and let him start all over again in circuit court. So the state's argument is essentially that since the habeas in which the cert action was reinstated did not lie, there was no subject matter jurisdiction, that the remainder of the proceeding would therefore be a nullity.
It didn't lie because habeas can't be brought unless somebody's in custody, isn't
that's
that
correct.
Right?
Under State versus Schill, habeas and 97406 require that you are not only in custody, but that you're in custody under the restraint that you are challenging.
So the subject matter jurisdiction is just another way of saying he wasn't in custody for habeas corpus purposes.
Correct.
So you don't have to use subject matter. We don't have to go to competence of the court. We can just say habeas corpus doesn't lie because he wasn't in custody for that particular offense.
That's correct. Okay.
But
correct.
Another way of approaching it, perhaps, is the way that your opposing counsel asserts, and as I understand the argument, he's saying, hey, what the court was doing was, as I understand the argument, exercising its jurisdiction with regard to the writ of cert. The parties stipulated to the reinstitution of the writ of cert. That's what they were doing, and so you do have jurisdiction based on the stipulation of the parties to reinstitute or reinstate the writ of cert. So you don't have to deal with habeas, although you got there by habeas. Indeed, the parties on their own or came up with a stipulation.
I think that's an artifice, though, because the only mechanism by which they were able to reinstate it was to go through filing a habeas corpus action that had a totally different case number in Dodge County, and then this cert action was reinstated by stipulation, and there had already been a prior certiorari action that went all the way up to this court.
If the habeas had not been brought, could these parties stipulate to reinstate the writ of cert?
I don't believe so.
Why not? I mean, why can't they come to the court and say, here's a stipulation, you know, we both signed it, and as I recall, the record isn't very clear on this whole stipulation of the writ of cert, how it came about. But, I mean, why can't they say, okay, I think there was a mistake. We should have been proceeding on this writ of cert. It was dismissed. So we now are voluntarily, the state is saying, agreeing to reinstate cert.
I don't think you could reinstate a cert action any more than you could stipulate to reinstate a criminal appeal after it had made its way all the way through the appellate courts. Just because the public defender and our office decides, okay, we're going to have this appeal all over again, I don't think the court would be too anxious to be taking appeals all over again just because we've done it by stipulation. And I think the same is true with a cert action.
It's a little hard here, it seems to me, because we really don't know the circumstances or why they stipulated. All of a sudden, we have a stipulation to reinstate the cert, as I understand the facts. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think that the record before this court doesn't show specifically why they stipulated. I think you can read between the lines, but I don't think the stipulation, for example, is not part of the record, and it was not even part of the record in the habeas action because I tried to get it from that record to put it into this court's record, and it's not even been filed there.
Yeah, I think a footnote of yours indicates kind of who knows.
It never got filed.
That's
apparently.
Right.
So, it got presented to Judge Klossner, and that was about it, I guess.
So what we know is there was a stipulation by the parties to reinstate the writ of cert. That's what we know. We don't know why. We don't know the conditions of that. We don't even know where the it never was filed.
But we know it arose in a habeas action. You can tell that from CCAP, and you can tell that from other documents in the record. That's correct. As for the underlying issue, it is the state's position that what occurred in this case is really similar to what happened in the two Masonman cases and unlike what happened in Woods or State X. Rel. Olson v. Litcher. In Masonman, you had a situation of a person who was about to reach their mandatory release date being told that as a condition of that parole, he had to wear an electronic monitoring bracelet or ankle bracelet, and Masonman refused to do so. Masonman never made it out onto the streets. Instead, he was immediately taken into custody on a parole hold, and that is the same thing that happened here. A lot has been made of the fact that Mr. Reisch was asked to sign his parole rules back in June prior to the July 21, 1998 date on which he would reach MR. However, the failure to sign the rules was not one of the specific allegations in the probation revocation charge. One of the charges was that he failed to find suitable housing on July 21, 1998, which is the same day that he was to attain mandatory release. One of the conditions that his agent was very straightforward about applying to him was that he had to have a suitable post-release residence, and one possibility was to be at, I believe it was Attic Correctional, another one was the Drug and Alcohol Correctional Center. But when Mr. Reisch found out that the places his agent wanted him to reside at required that he participate in some kind of treatment program, he refused to be situated there, and instead he told the agent that he wanted to go to a homeless shelter or a place like the Salvation Army. So this is a situation where basically at the same time he was reaching MR and he was in violation of the rules of probation and parole. And I think Justice Bradley gave a good example of how if you adopted the position being advocated by Mr. Chiarella, this would really elevate form over substance because you'd say, well, we have to wait until the mandatory release parolee gets outside and it's obviously clear that once he's not in any kind of physical custody, that he's not wearing an ankle bracelet or he's not going to a residence that's been approved by his agent. And I don't think the law requires that. And that is why...
If we turn the argument around and look at it from the state's perspective, as I understand your argument, the state can set forth then conditions that are unreasonable, and if the person refuses to acknowledge them, they now are subject to parole hold, they're not released, and they never get to the mandatory release status. In other words, isn't this a way around mandatory release?
I don't think so, because I don't think there's ever been a claim here that the rules of parole that were presented to Mr. Reisch were somehow unreasonable, and that wasn't the reason that the parole hold was placed. I think putting the requirement on a sex offender that you have to have suitable post-release housing is very reasonable, and that was one of the conditions that he refused to cooperate with.
Well, we all know that there's a problem in Milwaukee County with suitable housing for sex offenders. We've had numerous cases up here dealing with that. So if we get to the point where we're saying the condition is you have housing, and then the county has no housing to provide, then that doesn't that mean that the person then remains in custody indefinitely?
I think that's a different situation. I think the situation you're positing would be controlled by State Ex Rel Olson versus Litcher, where the department basically conceded on appeal that it had no statutory or administrative authority to hold Mr. Olson, but that it did not have suitable housing for him. And I think it was one of the situations you mentioned where the community just didn't want to locate that person. In those situations, the department can't just keep holding the person indefinitely and saying, well, we can't find a suitable place for you. That was not what happened here. What happened here was that the agent, Sandra Nelson, had approached Mr. Reisch about two different possible placements, and he refused to go to either one of them because he did not want to participate in the programming that was required of residents there. So our situation is very different. And I think another distinction is that here, Mr. Reisch was released, although not physically, but legally from the custody of a state prison into a county jail. And that's the distinction that was made between this case and the Woods case, because there, Woods was simply transferred from one state facility to another. So he was still a state prisoner. He was not going to a county jail where traditionally, as I think Justice Wilcox pointed out, that's where people under parole holds are held until their parole revocation proceedings are concluded.
But he was never released in this case at all.
Mr. Reisch was never physically released. That's correct.
So how do you attain the status of a parolee if you've never been released on parole?
Well, I think when you reach your MR date and you're given the rules of the institution and you're being transferred, in this case, to a jail because your mandatory release was contemporaneous with your violation. I mean, he was literally violating the rules of parole as he was being taken out of his jail cell from the, I think it was Kettle Moraine Correctional Institution. So when your violation is instantaneous, occurring at the same minute, I think it would be really a charade to say, well, we have to let this person go, take off the handcuffs, and walk 20 paces outside of the state correctional institution before we can slap the cuffs on him and take him to the nearest county jail to lodge a parole hold. I don't think that makes any sense. And I think it was clear from Mr. Reisch's pre-mandatory release communications with his agent that he was not going to abide by the regulations that were being imposed on him.
Does he have to sign anything, actually, under the rules in order to get parole?
I'm not sure what the failure to sign really does. I know it wasn't just a failure. He refused to sign. And I'm not sure if that in and of itself is enough to have any ramifications, or if it's just pretty much that when you sign it, it shows that you were notified of those conditions, so it shows that you couldn't later on say, well, I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to associate with, you know, my certain Confederates. When you have a signature, it's very clear that you were put on notice.
So when there's an MR date is achieved, do you automatically get on parole?
If it's mandatory release in the true sense, not they have some statutory presumptive mandatory release now, but I think that, yes, you are automatically entitled to be released. And that's why State Ex Rel Olson versus Litcher said When you reach that date, you have to be out. That case did not deal with a person who was violating the conditions.
No, but you have to be out on, you know, you can have supervised release, you can have probation, you can have parole, all of which are supervised release, or you can have outright discharge. If you reach the MR date, can you have outright discharge?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
If he had signed the paper, would he have been able to walk out the door?
No, because just signing it was insufficient. He still had to have cooperated with the efforts that his agent was making to find suitable post-release housing, and he did not. He specifically refused to live anywhere that required certain kind of treatment programs.
Right, but I thought that there was housing that they had found that they thought was suitable.
So that required this kind of situation, so he refused to go there.
But what was it that he was asked to sign? Wasn't that part of what he was asked to sign, that he would go to these a specified suitable location and participate in the treatment?
I don't believe that the rules were as specific as mentioning the place.
All right.
I think it was just in more general terms that you will abide by, you know, housing decisions. I don't have the actual rules in front of me, but I don't think it was specifically say you have to reside at Attic Correctional, for example. But the refusal to sign came on June 29th, and I'm not exactly sure when the notification or when Mr. Reish made it clear that he was not going to cooperate, but the date alleged in the probation revocation summary is July 21st. So we do know that long after his refusal to sign the rules, he was still being obstinate about not cooperating with the agent's plans for his housing.
So basically what he said is, you let me go, but I'm going to do what I want. I'm not going to follow the rules.
I believe that was the attitude that was expressed. And I don't think that under those circumstances there should be any requirement that the Department of Corrections let this person go physically free and then, as Justice Bradley said, follow them for, you know, 20 feet or 40 feet and then slap the cuffs on them and bring them in on a parole hold. It just seems to be elevating form over substance and making a mockery of the whole idea of what supervised parole or, in other cases, supervised release should be.
Justice Bradley asked a question about a possible petition to extend mandatory release. Could you comment on that, please?
I'm not familiar with that procedure. I think that it might have been mentioned in one of Mr. Chiarella's briefs, but I'm not really familiar with how that works. I know that in some crimes there's a presumptive mandatory release, but there's a procedure by which the state can indicate for whatever, there's certain reasons specified in by the statutes, I think two different reasons why you don't want to go with the presumptive mandatory release, and that only applies to certain offenders who've been convicted of, I believe it's sex crimes. But I'm sorry, I can't answer that specifically about extending MR.
On page 12 of your opposing counsel's brief, I think it is, he advances that there are options here, and the option would be that there should be the imposition of administrative sanctions or a loss of privileges, not a revocation of parole, and that's what he was advancing. But earlier, I think on page 9, in discussing the Woods case with regard to what administrative procedures are available, in that context, Woods apparently argued, as set forth on page 9 of the brief, that he should have been released in the community pursuant to the statute or given a hearing on extending his MR date, but that neither occurred. And so perhaps...
So that's where the reference came from. And I'm not, like I said, I'm not familiar with that. If the court has no further questions, the state would simply ask... Oh,
excuse me, I do. Thank you. The argument that going from, the argument that was persuasive to the Court of Appeals here, that going from a institution like a prison to a county jail is a different kind of custody such that one could be defined as having a dual status of both parolee and prisoner at the same time. And I know that that apparently appealed to the Court of Appeals and perhaps to members of this Court, but I just don't see why that makes any difference. Why should it make any difference if you're in a maximum security prison to go to a minimum security prison where you have oftentimes quite a bit of freedom, freedom to go out in the community with passes and much more freedom than you have sometimes in a county jail in some of these minimum securities like McNaughton and places where they do a lot of work outside of the, or they used to, I don't know in the last 10 years, but they used to. Why conceptually is there any difference between being in prison and in custody, and therefore, you say, not being amenable to a dual status, or being confined in county jail and being in custody, every bit as much as restraining your freedom as the other placement, and yet you can have dual status? Why does the difference of locality influence the ability to have dual status?
Well, I think it's kind of a fallacy to say that you could never have dual status and be both a parolee and a prisoner, because as one of the justices pointed out, if you're already out on the street on parole and you get a parole hold lodged against you, you are brought to the county jail. So you're being confined in the county jail. You are a prisoner of that jail, not of a state correctional facility. At the same time, you're still on parole until that parole has been revoked after going through the proper channels, including a preliminary and final revocation hearing. So you do have that dual status in some situations. I think the reason the locus of where you're being held makes a difference in this case is because if you truly have reached your mandatory release date and are being discharged from there, there's no reason to keep you in a state correctional facility, no matter how, you know, free you are to come and go. There's just not that legal authority. The reason you're held in the county jail is that that's where pre-revocation probationers and parolees are traditionally housed pending their revocation proceedings. So I do think that the change in locale does signal what the status of the person is, as in Woods, where he's just going from one state facility to another. He hadn't done anything to violate any conditions of parole. And so when he was transferred to a different facility, the Court of Appeals said, well, wait, you weren't a parolee because you never made it even to the, you know, county jail anywhere. You just went from one state institution to another. Whereas it's obvious from this case that the reason he was taken to the Dodge County Jail was because a parole hold was being lodged based in part on his failure to find suitable housing the same day that he attained his mandatory release date.
Ms. Moore, setting aside the jurisdictional issue for the moment, what do you think this opinion should say when it's written?
I think that the opinion should really distinguish between the situation of Masonman in the two Masonman cases and Woods in his case by indicating that there's no reason why a person has to be physically released from custody upon attaining MR if his violation of the rules of probation, or parole, is simultaneous or ongoing with achieving mandatory release date, but that the department is not free to just keep somebody in prison because the department is unable to find a suitable residence upon that person's release.
Counselor, should we conclude that by giving him conditions which have not been contended to be unreasonable, that he was constructively released by the giving of those conditions? Excuse me.
I think you could view it as constructive release. That's correct. It would be a very short period of time, but he was, and then just immediately violated. So the state asks this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals refusing to overturn the parole revocation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. Cheryl Aller.
I want to address the jurisdictional issue briefly, but before I do that, I want to get to this issue before I lose track. This kind of goes to some of the last questions that were posed to counsel. It's been stated that the failure to sign the rules, would that in and of itself have been a violation? Would that in and of itself have been enough to revoke? And I know I've been doing revocation proceedings for a number of years, and I've never seen a case where the failure to simply sign the rules in and of itself warrants revocation. And there's nothing under the DOC code that I could find which suggests that. So the failure to sign the rules, I don't believe, is a reason to revoke. A reason to revoke is failure to follow the rules. In any type of probation or parole case, I always tell my clients the same thing, and this is the way the law works. There has to be rules that you're under, rules that you're provided with. There has to be conduct alleged which suggests that you violated those rules. And unless and until a person is given the opportunity to violate the rules, revocation is never started. I think it's important to note in this particular case that although my client, or any client for that matter, may say, you can give me those rules, I'm not going to sign them, I'm not going to follow them, that being the case, can we constructively hold that person in prison or in jail or what have you, keep that person in custody? The simple response, I believe, is no, because the person hasn't yet been given the opportunity on the outside through conditional liberty to follow the rules.
Counsel, I'm going to refer you for a moment to Section 30211, paren 4, Mandatory Release Statute. An inmate may waive entitlement to mandatory release if the department agrees to waiver.
Okay.
And it comes again to, and that goes to the questions that I asked about refusing to sign the rules. And I understand that wasn't a ground for the revocation, but we then pre-revocation stage. When he refuses to sign those rules, can this court say that that activity waives the entitlement to mandatory release?
This court obviously has the authority and the power to do that. Should the court do that? Unless specifically stated under the code, I would say no. I mean, simply not signing rules in and of itself is not enough to say I waive my mandatory release. I mean, I don't think, I guess if it's placed in the prison, if you don't sign the rules, you are effectively waiving your right to mandatory release. If the prisoner is posed with that question, I would imagine the prisoner is going to say, fine, I'll sign them. But for this court to come right out and say failure to sign the rules in the absence of a specific DOC administrative code section on point, the answer to your question, from my perspective, is no. One other thing I wish to answer is, and Justice Butler came up with a great example, and I wish I had done it myself, was that what if we have an agent that comes up with unreasonable rules and, in essence, the client looks at him and says, there's no way I'm going to sign these rules. There's no way I'm going to follow these rules. They're completely unreasonable. That gets back to what I'm saying before. This opens the door to potential abuse by the agents. And we talked previously about a facade. Are we putting form over substance? Well, maybe. But if form has to be put over substance simply to at least potentially eliminate abuse, why not do it?
Don't we just have a different case? I mean, it's a different case. Jeff says it's a different case if your client had been willing to go to an appropriate setting, but the county failed to find the setting. That's a different case. It's also a different case if the rules were unreasonable. And that's why when I posed my question to opposing counsel, I said, you know, can we say he was constructively released when the rules put to him were not challenged as unreasonable, and he simply refused to accept them, acknowledging he has to follow the rules. I mean, I understand your problem, and I'm troubled by the dual status, but I'm also troubled by setting up charades for, you know, folks to follow when they're trying to manage people that they're trying to get back in a setting that's appropriate so they can stay outside of prison.
I understand, and all I can say is I think that the attitudes of people will change if faced with the prospect that, hey, I either play ball when I get out of this place or once I get out, if the agent tells me you play ball, I either start playing ball or I'm going right back, and the person turns around and sees, I don't want to go back to that place. Once again, you can't revoke that which does not exist. My perspective is, unless given the opportunity to fail to follow the rules, how can we constructively say that the person didn't do it? I mean, if the rules say you have to go live at DAC or you have to go live at a halfway house in Milwaukee. And people have been there before and say, I can't stay in those halfway houses, I'm not going to do it. But then faced with the prospect of going back into prison, they may well do it. So to constructively say that we're going to do that, I don't believe is appropriate. Because you're kind of circumventing the right, at least from my perspective, of allowing one to go from a deprivation to conditional liberty.
So what you're saying, you got to put him out there and let him break the rules of probation, even though he's telling you that's what he, or parole, even though he's telling you that's what he's going to do.
Right, but just because somebody says something doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to happen.
Why in the world would he say it if he really wanted to just be on the street and get on with his life, if he wasn't going to do it?
I don't know. People do different things for different reasons.
Yeah, that's true. Keeps us all busy. Thank you.
My stoplight is on. Could I briefly, just very briefly, address the jurisdictional issue?
Short sentence. Mm-hmm.
I cited the Hakey case with regards to the jurisdictional issue. If the court finds that the habeas in any way, shape, or form impacted upon the writ of cert, which I believe we can stipulate to as any given civil case. I mean, whenever we have a civil matter, you can stipulate to reopening once the judgment is paid and dismissing is done all the time. So since this was a civil matter, you can stipulate at any time. But if the court finds that habeas gave rise, I think the Hakey case pretty much sets into perspective that these were two separate sentences that were joined together on the date of sentencing. So at the time that he filed this writ of habeas corpus, in essence, he was under the constraints of that one continuous sentence.
One disposition.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to Mr. Tirola, and thank you to Ms. Moore for your arguments today on 03-0920, State Ex Rel Leroy Reich versus David Schwartz. That concludes our oral arguments for today. We are in recess. The court will meet in the conference room at 3, and we will be back for oral argument at 8:45 tomorrow morning. 9:45. We are in recess.